session number 17363, reel 1.
Mr. Barraclough, Reel 1, where were you born, please?
I was born in a place called Wombwell, near Barnsley.
Which year was this?
In 1920.
Did you have your upbringing and schooling in Wombwell?
My early schooling was in Wombwell, yes.
Did you move away from the town, village?
My secondary education was at the grammar school in Barnsley.
How old were you when you left school?
I left school when I was 16.
Did you get a job?
Yes. I worked in the head office of the Yorkshire Traction Company in Barnsley.
Were you doing that when war was declared?
I was.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain's broadcast declaring war on Germany?
Yes, I think so.
What were your feelings when you heard that we were at war?
I don't know. I think it was something I expected. But I had no particular feelings at that time, as far as I remember.
No sense of dismay or...
No, I don't think so.
How did the war first affect you, personally?
Well, I decided that I wanted to get into it. And, as it were, do my bit. And I didn't want to wait for a call-up. I decided that I wanted to choose what I was going to do in the war effort. And so I decided to try to enlist in the Royal Air Force.
How did you go about it?
This is a long time ago. I think I went to Sheffield, where I took a medical examination for the Air Force, and this I passed, and was accepted for training in aircrew, because I wanted to fly.
What had put the idea of flying into your head?
well, I didn't want to go into the army. I decided that a place in the Air Force would be for me, so I took the medical examination in Sheffield and was accepted, and it went on from there. I went on from there to Padgett, I believe, where I enlisted. I think took the oath and so on, and remained there for a while, and Then went on to Wimslow in Cheshire, where I did some basic training, square drill, rifle drill, and so on, which I think every chap in the Air Force had to do.
How did the people in charge treat you in the basic training?
Oh, very well, as far as I remember.
Because we sometimes hear nowadays about ill treatment or bullying.
Yes, I don't think that was present, not during my time anyway.
And then?
From Wimslow, I went to Thornaby-on-Tees, which was a coastal command station, and there I took part in station defence with others of my group who had moved there, and this was a 24-hour duty out on the station, manning an anti-aircraft gun, 20mm, 24 hours on and 24 hours off. And I remained there for some short time until there was a place for me on a wireless course in Blackpool.
Did the German Air Force launch any attacks at Thornaby-on-Tees?
I don't remember any, but they were about, one could hear, the 4.5 ACAT guns in the area at different times.
Did you at that time personally think the Germans would invade?
That never occurred to me. I never thought about it.
What were your hopes as far as the job you were to do in the Air Force was concerned?
The whole thing at that stage was how can I say, a period of when there was, I was not responsible for anybody. I was responsible only for myself, and I didn't feel any responsibility for anybody else. It was something of a game at that stage, I think, really.
And the next step in your training?
Then I was posted to Blackpool and I began the first part of my wireless telegraphy training and began to learn the Morse code, and at Blackpool we were taken up to 12 words a minute, I think it was, and we had tests every week, and when this period was finished we were posted to Yatesbury in Wiltshire to carry on with our wireless training.
And then?
And then we had more lessons in Morse code. Speed was increased, and we had lessons on RAF equipment, transmitters and receivers, and we had our first taste of flying there. We flew in, I think they were called de Havilland Dominies and Percival Proctors, and at the end of that time I went from there to I have to think about these moves, there were so many. I went from Yatesbury
to Grantham,
12 flying training school, and there we were fairly free to do what we liked. Okay. There we got our flying kit. We thought that was a good sign. And we all dressed up and were photographed in our flying kit. I remember little else about Grantham except that they were flying fairy battles at that time. And then from Grantham it was back to
Yatesbury,
that's right, for a refresher course, and then from Yatesbury on to OTU, Operational Training Unit, number 11, at Basingbourne, which was equipped with Wellingtons, and the really serious training began there, and we did our gunnery there as well.
In the training, did you personally have any problems with any aspect of the courses?
No, it was plain sailing as far as I was concerned. I'm glad to say. I enjoyed it. I realised afterwards that quite a lot of it seemed a little bit unnecessary, but still, there we are. I think one had to go through it. A lot of the theory in the wireless course seemed to be unnecessary, but we did it.
What was your attitude by now towards going on operations?
Well, I think one looked forward to joining a squadron. I did, at any rate. This is what we'd been aiming for all the way through, and it looked as though we were going to become a member of a squadron, and we did. We were posted from there to Feltwell, which was a three-group bomber station, and I was posted to 57 Squadron. There were two squadrons on the base, 57 and 75. 75 was a New Zealand squadron, therefore most of its members were from New Zealand, but 57 Squadron was a very mixed bag. Canadians, New Zealanders, English, quite a mixture. And in my crew, we had a Canadian navigator, the captain of the aircraft was a New Zealander, and the rest of us were English. And we settled in pretty well. And we were briefed to go to Emden on our first op. And this was pretty straightforward. And so we settled into the squadron there.
You joined the squadron on the 21st of September 41, according to your records.
Right.
What did the atmosphere and morale in the squadron seem to be like when you first joined it?
Well, I thought it was pretty good. There was nothing to indicate that things were going badly. Yes? No, I think I was reasonably content there.
how comfortable or uncomfortable was it flying in the Wellington in those days?
Well, the Wellington was a a stout old aircraft. She was invented by Barnes Wallace, of course, and the geodetic construction, which was a light framework, was covered with fabric, and you could fill her full of holes, but if she caught fire, she was done for. And of course, at that time, we were not equipped with aids to bombing. These came later.
Did you have fire extinguishers in the plane?
I think so. Yes, I think we did. I don't ever remember them being employed. I think so.
Where were you positioned in the plane to do your job?
Well, my trade was wireless operator air gunner, but I was the wireless operator on all the operations that I took part in. I don't know why particularly, because there were two WAPAGs on a Wellington. The other one sat in the front turret, and I sat in the wireless operator's position, of course.
Where was that?
This was between the pilot and the navigator.
Did you just have a table?
Yes, a table and the transmitter and receiver in front of me.
How effective were the wirelesses in the Wellington?
Well, excuse me. They were pretty powerful sets. Did what they were meant to do, and an essential part of the aircraft, of course. The time did come when we relied entirely on the radio, and it got us out of a jam, but that was later on.
Which operations, can you take me through any operations that stick out in your memory, please?
Well, the one that sticks out, apart from the last one, most in my memory, was the one on the 7th of November, 1941, when 37 aircraft were lost. We had been briefed to bomb Berlin, and we set off directly to the target. The weather conditions were turned out to be very bad. We bombed through 10/10 cloud, and on the way back we lost our way. The navigator had no idea where we were. We'd flown far south of our course, and it was up to me to get a fix, to find out our position. This wasn't easy, but I persisted, and finally we got a fix from Hull, fixed our position and found that we were considerably south of our course, and we thought we might just make Manston in Kent, and we set course for Manston, and we landed there with about enough petrol to have completed one more circuit of the aerodrome. So that was very touch and go. Many of the aircraft, of the 37 that were lost in the sea. So I think perhaps they got lost.
What had happened to your bomb load?
The bombs had been dropped on what we called ETA, estimated time of arrival, over Berlin.
What was the enemy opposition like over Berlin?
Well, we weren't too worried. We bombed through 10/10 cloud. They couldn't see us. There was a lot of heavy flak, but it didn't bother us.
Were the other raids as far as Berlin?
I think that was the most distant raid that I did. Yes.
What other type of places were you going to?
The raid upon which we were shot down was Dusseldorf. This, of course, was in the Ruhr, and on this occasion we set out with a bomb load of 3,500 pounds, 1,000 pound bomb, and 500 pounders. And the Ruhr wasn't a very popular area for bombing. We called it Happy Valley. It was the reverse, really. And we took off at 5:15 and climbed to 12,000 feet, crossing the coast at Orford Ness. The second pilot at that stage was in charge of the aircraft, and we crossed the sea and the Dutch coast, where a lot of light flak came up. And the second pilot began the weaving on his way to the target, which was normal. And as we got near to Dusseldorf, we could see aircraft ahead bombing, and all those nasty things that one expected over the target were there. And we went in to bomb. It was a nice moonlight night, and over the target we identified the target without too much trouble, went over it and turned back, and identified the target. But then things were getting pretty rough. There's a lot of heavy flak coming up and bursting around the aircraft, and we were picked up by the searchlights, got into a cone, all the searchlights converged, and we dropped our bombs. And then the pilot decided that he'd got to get out of this, so he pushed the control column forward and went into a dive, and we screamed out of this and levelled out at about 7,000 feet, setting course for home at the same time. And it was then that really our troubles began, because certainly the aircraft was it's difficult to describe, really, but there was a curtain of fire across the aircraft, an absolute curtain of fire, and the skipper gave the order to abandon aircraft, and the navigator raised the escape hatch, and he went through and I followed him, having clipped on my parachute. And I came out of the aircraft and the parachute opened, fortunately. But the aircraft continued on its downward course, and I saw it strike the ground and explode. There was no sign of any other parachute in the sky. The navigator had gone out first, but his chute wasn't below me, and there were no parachutes above me. So I landed in the middle of a field. It was covered with snow. This was December 1941, and I bundled up my parachute and harness, Mae West, and stuffed them in the bottom of a dike alongside the field, and started to walk away from the aircraft. And carried on for some time. I suppose I must have walked 4 or 5 miles. Wasn't sure whether I was in Germany or in Holland, but as we'd set course, I thought we were probably in Holland. So I looked to a fairly isolated farmhouse and approached it and knocked at the door, and I was what I thought was well received, because they took me in and gave me something to eat, and I had my escape map with me, which I got out, and they indicated that I was in fact just inside the Dutch border. So they gave me something to eat, and I indicated that I was ready to lie down, and they took me to the back of the house. It was the sort of farmhouse with buildings at the back for animals. I was taken to the back and given a bed in a corner, and settled down there. But I hadn't been there very long. I'd gone to sleep, but I was awakened, and there were two men in uniform standing by me. One was apparently a sergeant of police, and the other was a corporal, and they said they were sorry, but they'd have to take me in. Clearly I had been taken in by these Dutch people. I didn't see them again, but the police borrowed a bicycle for me, and we cycled away from this place. The sergeant rode in front and the corporal behind, and I cycled in the middle. I always remember that the cycle had a what they call a back pedal brake, and every time I tried to freewheel, the bicycle slid on the icy road. Anyway, we carried along some distance, and the sergeant stopped at a house, and this is where he lived apparently, and he took me in there and introduced me to his wife, who cried. And I tried to give her the impression that things really...